Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Spurs in full cry here.
Okay, so we had a question from Adam Joes. I think it's Joes. He says, I was playing FIFA and managing academy players for loaning, selling and promotion is his favourite part of the game. He said, I wonder what you guys think goes into the decision of when an academy player is ready to be promoted. I'm sure it's positionally specific, but it's clearly exceptional traits or a set of traits, confidence or comfort at current level, dominance of lower competitions, a lack of specific negative traits, physical attributes, etc., etc. With this template in mind, how do Spurs academy players look, particularly thinking of readiness to contribute? I obviously have an interest in this, and I've got a lot to say. And I've actually gone through and looked at how five players from our academy were integrated. Bardi, do you have any specific thoughts about what the signs might be that an academy player is ready to play?
I think for a lot of them, they need a slice of good luck. So if you look across our kind of graduates that have made something of themselves, so Mason, Bentaleb for that short period of time, Harry Kane, Tanganga, I think they've been able to be almost ready and lucky to have that opportunity to play. And then it's a question obviously of talent and everything else to back them up. But I think, unfortunately, I think a lot of it does come down to luck, especially when your managers aren't so kind of risk averse, when they don't really want to promote youth players.
Nathan, how about you? Any initial thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what Vardy has said is luck plays, like, you get into sort of pre-promotion situation. You get into like standby, you get to a couple of bench appearances, and then it stops there. And you have to, like, if you know the player in front of you has to get injured or suspended, or two players have to get injured and suspended, or there has to be some sort of crisis that allows you to break through to actually getting minutes, if we look at pretty much all of these players. And for me, that doesn't point to a particularly good system if it's based on luck. Like Gareth Bale, if we remember, out of the team, was not getting minutes, and then Assel Kossu was injured for a long time and Bale got a run of games that allowed him to establish himself in the team. Like, what if that never happened?
Absolutely. No, I fully agree. And I think our strategy in developing young players, in fact, not developing young players, in bringing through young players needs some serious work.
But this is a problem that is unique to the top five or six teams in England.
That's fair.
That Ben Foden, for example, Manchester City, Ben Foden is
Ben Fogel.
Ben Fogel. Anyway,
he's a posh twat.
Yeah.
Okay. Had he been playing lower down the division, he would have more minutes. And I think it is a problem with the top teams.
Yeah.
The opening doesn't happen. And as Nathan says, when your game is based so much on stats and science and everything else, it's ridiculous that you have to rely on luck for these young players to progress. And I'm sure as you go through your list of players, Wendy, we could all point to a moment where they just needed something to break their way for those minutes to come and for them to play. Then perhaps Onoma, Kyle Walker-Peters would have gone on to be good players for Tottenham.
Right, yeah. I think there's a simple solution to the Foden issue, though, and that is loans. City don't need to have kept Foden around for the limited number of minutes he's had over the last two, three seasons. He could have had two or three seasons of playing at a very good level and got loads of experience and now might be a prominent player in their first team. Sorry, Nathan, I cut in. You were going to say something
there. Well, just that whenever you mention Foden, there's the obvious and extremely easy comparison with Sancho, right? Foden and Sancho, the same age in the same youth team, playing for the England under-17s, won the under-17 World Cup together, and then Sancho went to Dortmund, where he'd been bought a month earlier, and tore things up, and Foden is still a sort of bench-riding, promising young player. Sancho's going to transfer for hundreds of millions of pounds.
Right, yeah.
Dortmund are like, okay, I accept Bardi's point of like, it's we're at the very top of football, and therefore it's harder for academy players to break through, but like, Dortmund are like not a small-time outfit. Like, they're not a dramatic step down from City, whereby they can't possibly, you know, where a 17-year-old turns up and just is immediately gonna dominate their team. They gave him chances, they gave him time. They you know, he wasn't starting right immediately. He was playing 45 minutes here, 20 minutes there, and he earned his place by performing in those minutes. But he was given those minutes, and not just like spread out over an entire season, but he was given, you know, some minutes most weeks as he built his place in the team. And I think that it was certainly possible for Foden to have done exactly the same as City, even though they have an embarrassment of talent.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's often about faith and about opportunity. And I mean, Tanganga is the first person on my list to talk about, and he's not let us down. This is the thing. Very few of the best youth players. Let me caveat this. I'm not saying that we should be throwing in players like, I don't know, Will Miller or Cy Goddard, who went on to not be anywhere near good enough to play Premier League football. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the top sort of 10% of your intake, your academy players, will not let you down. So Tanganga got thrown in completely unexpectedly against Liverpool, and he was great. I mean, he's one of our best players in that game. He's had a couple of games where he's been not so perfect, but he's also had some very good games. And we've now got a player whose value is probably 4-5 times what it was when he hadn't played at all. And let's not forget with Tanganga that he only got a chance in pre-season due to injuries to John Dinzey, who is going to be released at the end of the season and is, dare I say, rubbish, and TJ Ayoma, who is on loan at Lincoln City now. So Tanganga was ahead of them in the pecking order. Nothing happened during his development to maintain the kind of... He basically came out of the under-18s a really good player, and then that upward trajectory just tailed off. And what you find then is that the players behind you who then come out of the under-18s looking good overtake the ones who stagnated, and that's so wrong. We're not harnessing the talent available. And one of the problems with Tanganga is that he was never allowed out on loan. So I know that he wanted to go out on loan. His agency wanted to send him out on loan, and the club didn't want that to happen for some reason. The same with Oliver Skip, so he's next in my list. It's been a very slow stop-start development for Skip. He played 402 minutes for our first team in 18-19. No minutes at all for any of our youth teams, which is odd. Not allowed out on loan. This year he's played under 300 minutes, but he has played some minutes for the youth team. I mean, I'm not happy with how Skip's been developed. I think he's one that could easily have been out on loan in the Championship or maybe even a lower Premier League club this year. And again, we'd be able to benefit from that next season and from the increase in value if we don't think he's good enough. One that stands out as slightly different is Harry Winks. So Winks, and I can't remember when I first heard this, but I heard at quite an early stage, I think he was 16 at the time, that Winks was training up with the first team. He was absolutely tiny at that point. There was nothing to him, really little guy,
playing
number 10. Yeah. He was playing higher, or certainly more box to box than he's become. And he just kind of, they spotted something in Winks and moved him up to the first team squad really early. And he didn't play, he didn't get games. So he made his Europa League debut in 14-15, just a handful of minutes. He played a good number of under 21 minutes that season. 15-16, he got 17 minutes in the Europa League, and he played a few less games in under 21s. And then the next season he broke through. So we kind of stuck with him. We got him integrated into the first team picture, and obviously he showed some personality, as the coaches like to like to say. They like to sort of, they like to talk about the sort of the mental, intangible aspects of a young player, and say yes, he's, you know, he's stamping his authority in training. He's shown that he's as good as the first team players, which I find troubling, to be honest. But that Winks does stand out. Did that ever occur to you, Nathan, as unusual, Winks's development?
No, because I don't think I had that strong a sort of lens on what was going on. So he, yeah, I remember the Europa League debut. He came off the bench at the same time as Onuma, I think, or within a few minutes of Onuma, and they both were making their... Is that right?
I think you're right, yeah. Okay, I think you're
they
right.
came up, yeah, and it was sort of... It was like... Because at that time, it was... That was when Pochettino's sort of legacy as a promoter of young players was really being cemented, because Kane had broken through and everything, and Mason and Townsend and so on. Okay, those players didn't get their debut minutes, but you get the point. And then it was like, and here's the next batch, and it's like, and it was Winks and Onuma getting their first taste of minutes. So I remember writing a blog for the Fighting Cock blog saying in 2016, 2017, maybe, that like it was time for Winks to replace Moussa Dembélé.
Wow.
Which is an article that got some negative feedback, as you can imagine, but it was that it was less about Winks, who I was definitely excited about, and I think that hasn't fulfilled on the excitement as much as I had for him. Has certainly turned out to be a Premier League level player regardless. But it was more just sort of Moussa Dembélé is clearly physically deteriorating, and there doesn't seem to be any kind of mitigation plan for that. We're still struggling to replace him now.
Yeah, that's fair. Bardi, the other thing I remember about Winks' development is that we would bring him on in games where there was still some meaning to the game. So it wasn't like we were 3-0 up and the game was over and we were just giving players minutes just to sort of say, see how you do. Winks was brought on to almost help close out games with his possession style. Do you have any kind of memories of Winks' first few matches?
I think the one that always stands out whenever you talk about Winks' start is the game away at Real Madrid.
Oh, God, it was where, so good.
Yeah,
we're up against an incredibly like star-studded midfield. He more than held his own. I like Winks. I don't think Winks is going to be a hugely influential player on our first 11 going forward, but I think he remains an integral part of the squad. I like his attitude. I like the way he plays. He keeps the ball and everything else. He's not going to be a world beater, but he, you know, sometimes every kitchen needs someone who chops the onions, and I think he's a useful player to have around.
Yeah, he is. You're right. He's a good egg as well. He's got a good head on his shoulders. He's just a good lad to have around the place.
Yeah.
But he just comes off as a really smart, knowledgeable footballer. And I do think that's quite important. I definitely agree with Nathan that he's not become what we hoped.
No.
And he's not pressed on as much as we hoped. But to develop a player of the calibre of Winks is absolutely no bad thing. He's a very solid Premier League player that most clubs would love to have in their teams. And you know, counts towards our homegrown quota too. So there's that. Another player I'd like to talk about is Onuma, and a lot of people will sigh at this point and think that I was weirdly obsessed with a player who was nothing, and the fact that he's at Fulham now proves that to be the case. So I think Onuma, along with Walker Peters, was the most mismanaged of all of our youth players. So Onuma, as a 17-year-old, or perhaps even 16, was wanted by Man City. He was seen as one of the brightest talents in academy football in the country. And that was because he was excellent. He was really good. He was mainly an attacking midfielder. He'd often play box-to-box too. I think he kind of played attacking midfield because he was given freedom to run with the ball more. When he played the central midfield role, he was competent, but you didn't get to kind of see him driving forward. So Onuma made his debut in 2014-15. He was brought on for 40 minutes on the right of midfield, and he'd at that point mostly played all of his under 21 minutes at attacking midfield or central midfield. Then in the next season, 15-16, he played just over 500 minutes at attacking midfield, left midfield, central midfield, right midfield, mostly in the cup when there's like a piece together team just to sort of rotate rotate players en masse. He barely played any minutes for the under-21s in that season. There was a game against Monaco where he played in a midfield three with Tom Carroll and Eric Dier against Moutinho and Bakayoko, who went on to sign for Chelsea, and we won 4-1. And I remember Onuma, as well as Carroll, having very good games. Onuma was really impressive in that match. And that was the moment where I think we should have said, okay, yeah, let's carry on developing this midfielder. And that is the kind of player who could, I think, have replaced Moussa Dembélé.
I was there for that game, and I remember being extremely excited about Onuma after that match and what was going to happen next for him.
You weren't alone. There was a lot of excitement for the first time. And then he got cameos on the right, on the left. And it's like, he's not a winger. We're not going to get the best out of him playing on the wing. It's not good for his confidence. And some people would argue, you know, if you're a young player, you've got to take your chance wherever you get it on the pitch. And I think the onus needs to be on the club to put the player in the best position to have a chance. Then in 16-17, he got under 300 minutes, mostly in the cup, barely played under 21. So that's two seasons of barely playing any football. By that point, my faith in us developing him had waned. He was, however, still in England's reckoning in the 2017 FIFA Under-20 World Cup. He played in midfield alongside Lewis Cook. He was excellent. He did get sent off and missed the semi-final, but he was back in for the final against Venezuela. And he was good. I heard some rumours that perhaps he came back from that with a bit of a chip on his shoulder. And that he thought maybe that's it now. I'm going to make it. I was one of the stars of this wonderful England team. I don't know whether that was the case or not.
But if it was the case, isn't that reasonable?
Yeah. And why not harness that?
Yeah.
Obviously, it hasn't worked out for them since. He's been on loan in the Championship. He played 1,800 minutes in 17-18. He's now moved on to Fulham.
He's doing well at Fulham. Deal.
He is. He got off to a rocky start, but he's won their fans round. I mean, I honestly think that Onuma will become a Premier League player. I think he massively stagnated at Spurs, and it's very difficult to then get back on the upward curve.
Given that he had that stagnation, that difficult time, and he's now one of the Championship's better players, that does point to the idea that, you know, he would have been on course to be a Premier League player for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not going to say the same about Walker Peters, but I could. There were many years where he didn't get enough games. He was essentially playing more games for his country than he was for his club at any level, which is just madness, absolute madness. And then when he did get chances, he was in and out of the team. So he came in, he was man of the match, and he was dropped. He came in again, he was one of the best players, he was dropped, which, you know, it's not great. And it seems to me that all the comments on Walker Peters from coaches, from Pochettino, from Mourinho, has been about his personality, that he needs to be more assertive, more vocal. And my argument is, well, you've had this kid at the club since he was 10 years old, or whatever, 9 years old, I think. If you could have had more control over his development of his personality from a young age, but there we go. I think, like Bardi said earlier, Walker Peters is done at Spurs. And then we have Kane. So Kane's development was totally different. Kane was managed, his development was managed by, I believe, Les Ferdinand. So Ferdinand was in charge of sorting out loans at Spurs, along with Sherwood. Sherwood and Ferdinand would manage the under-21s and sort out loans. And Kane was someone who was sent out on crucial loans, which didn't always go well, but gave him a solid grounding in League One, in the Championship, then the Premier League at Norwich, where it didn't really work out. He got a metatarsal injury and he got recalled back, and he was sent out to Leicester. But we gave him opportunities to develop his game, develop his the physical side of his game, so that when he needed to be called upon, he was ready. However, and Bardi made this point, that it's often all about luck. Kane was, so his breakthrough season was 13-14. He was scoring goals left, right and centre in the Premier League 2, which was then, it's the under-23 league as it was then. He got a back injury, but then he came back and he started to make the bench in February. We had Soldado and we had Adebayor. And Soldado was playing absolutely terribly. He looked like a broken man. But Pochettino was persisting with Soldado game after game. He got injured. He got a hamstring injury. Harry Kane comes in. We beat Sunderland 5-1. Kane gets a golden assist. He then scores three matches in a row. It was a Sherwood, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that was Sherwood.
Sherwood. Yeah. Sorry, I'm getting my timelines wrong. Sherwood was in charge. He put faith in Kane, and Kane didn't let him down.
He was so good against Sunderland in that game. You sort of fall into the trap there. People discuss Kane as a player that Pochettino brought through, but there were, I don't think I was alone in being excited about Kane at the end of that season there, after the Sunderland game especially. He scored 3 goals in 5 games or something like that. Oh, you've got a note down here.
Sherwood was an idiot. Of course he was an idiot, but we owe him for Harry Kane, big time. So Pochettino then joins in May, and the next season starts 2014-15. Harry Kane is a sub. Adebayor starting games, and Kane and Soldado are on the bench. Kane is getting Europa League matches as a rotation, and he's outplaying both of our other strikers and scoring regularly. And yet, and at the back end of the previous season, he's been given a chance. He's scored in 3 matches in a row. But because he's a young academy player, he's not trusted over these well-paid professional footballers who've been at the best clubs in Europe. And it's only when he comes on for Adebayor against Villa and scores a deflected free kick that things get turned around. So Boddy is absolutely right that young players need luck in the current structures. I wonder whether this will change. John McDermott is leaving Spurs. We've got a new coach, obviously, in Mourinho, who has a different philosophy around loans than Pochettino had. Perhaps this will change, and I hope that one good thing that could come from coronavirus is that if clubs are slightly less likely to spend money, that they trust their young prospects, because there's a ridiculous amount of untapped talent amongst English youth academies. God, I've spoken a lot there. Any closing thoughts, Bardi?
Just touching on Sherwood, it's very easy to make these big gambles when there's not really much at stake. Sherwood, he had to change things. He was there for a short term. He needed to make an impact. He threw Kane in, he threw Bentaleb in, and that kind of stuff. So it's easy. The one that he always talks about, Peter Taylor, when he made David Beckham captain. He was like, I saw what was going to happen there with Beckham. No, you didn't, mate. You had one game. You decided to try something to make a name for yourself, and it just so happened that you gave it to Beckham, who went on to do good things for England. With Kane, it's amazing. It's an amazing story, and I think there is a lot of luck involved in there, because he had some terrible loan deals, but he is that guy that when the moment came, he stepped up. And even when the opportunity came under Pochettino, which was a lot further in, he bided his time. He was patient. I think it's a shame what's happened to Onuma, Kyle Walker-Peters, these kind of guys. Perhaps they needed to leave Spurs earlier and work their way through a different way. Sometimes it's not just the club that needs to be brave, it's the player. Walker-Peters probably had opportunities to leave Spurs, but 100%. he signed that contract, which is fair enough. It's his career as well, so he wants stability. Maybe he doesn't want to go play with a load of farmers in the Championship. He wants to hang around at Spurs.
No, you're right. The players are so dependent on the advice they get from agents and from their families. And I do think agents like to have players at Premier League clubs, when actually sometimes taking a step down would be the right thing to then come back up. I think that's a really good point.
It takes bravery. We've mentioned Sancho. It takes a lot of guts to uproot, go to another country and try to make it, because in football, every transfer is a gamble, not just for the club, but for the player. And yeah, it's unfortunate, but that's just the way football. Football is littered with young players who could have been great. Look through, while you were talking, I looked through the England under 20 team just to see who was alongside Onuma and Walker-Peters. And the players in there that we'll never see again, but then there are other players who are making a name for themselves.
Mm. No, you're quite right. Nathan, any closing thoughts from you?
Just on Kane, that I remember him getting a start. I think it was against Stoke during his sort of good Europa League run, and he performed poorly in that match. I think he wasn't served very well by his teammates. I remember that being like, oh no, we all got it wrong about Kane, and he's actually not very good at all.
I think he plays with Soldado.
Is that right?
I've got a feeling that Kane played just behind Soldado.
Sure, yeah, that would make sense. And yeah, that was a poor game for him, and that was his first Premier League start under Pochettino, and it looked like the hype was to not be believed. And then he went back to Europa League games and carried on scoring in buckets, and then got that sub on against Villa.
I can't remember, but I imagine my Twitter mentions were an absolute mess.
Yeah.
Okay, so loads more questions. Doran, who is Doz23 on Twitter, he says, what impact, if any, will this virus have on football, in your opinion, from a scale of no impact to football will never be the same again? Bardi, what are your immediate thoughts?
I think this might have a significant impact on attendances and people's willingness to kind of mix again, because I'm missing the human contact of other people. And just, I don't know how people will feel from going, you must be 2 metres away, you must stay at home, to all of a sudden being in Beavertown at White Hart Lane, where there's people sticking their fingers in your beer and there's people on top of you all the time. I think from an independent social kind of way, it's going to have a huge impact. On football as a business, I think we need to see how long this lasts. But as you said, sometimes if there is less money going around, perhaps we will see more clever coaching, better work, better tactical work, and young players will get their opportunities.
How about you, Nathan? Do you think football finances will recover from this?
I mean, eventually, I guess, but I think that the impact is going to be significant. I think that the world is going to be different. I think that this is going to go on for a lot longer than we're talking about, or if it doesn't, we're going to open up and then there'll be a second wave. Yeah, exactly. I think we'll be living in a somewhat different world when football, or maybe they do football in a bubble in 3 stadiums in the Midlands and the footballers are extracted away from their families. That's kind of absurd, but I think it'll be significant, and I think that the financial ramifications will be going on for a long time. And I think that furloughing staff will be something that either will be taken out of chairman's hands or certainly should be. And a lot of clubs will, maybe not Tottenham level clubs, but I think a lot of clubs will go under in the near future.
That's a very sad prospect, isn't it?
Sorry.
But it kind of shows that the structure of our national sport is not right if clubs are going to go under because of something like this, where there's so much money at the top. There should be a buffer in place, and maybe it will be an opportunity to change the structure, to create a buffer, to protect some of those clubs that serve their communities so well. I hope so. I don't know. Right, I think I might need my change of pace siren for this one, but I haven't got it handy, so I'll just... Beautiful. So Sai, who is actual Sai, says, what are you having for dinner? Nathan, what's on the menu for you tonight?
I don't know about tonight. We just had a delivery, which is such a relief in these circumstances. But on Tuesday night, I have dinner with my friends who live down in Brighton, and we get on Skype together and we have dinner at the same time, and they live around the corner from an Asian supermarket, and it's empty. People are racistly not going to the Asian supermarket. Wow. Right, even though the virus is here, right, it's like the Tesco is considerably more dangerous because there's more people in it than the specialist Asian supermarket, but they are happily taking advantage of that. Right, they don't have to go far, they don't have to come across other people, they go to this shop, they know that when they go to the shop they're helping a local business stay in business under difficult circumstances. So they are eating entirely Asian, mainly Japanese food at the moment. And when this started out, it was before that, and we were doing a, what are you guys having for dinner tonight? Oh, you're having a pasta based meal, I'll cook a based pasta meal, right? That sort of thing, being a bit cute with it. And now they're exclusively eating Japanese food. So I'm every Tuesday I'm having to sort of rummage around the cupboards based on what I'm getting delivered, which is difficult, and try to scrape together, you know, pork and rice with sauces. But I have a stomach issue at the moment where I'm reacting really horrifically to like even the most mild of spices. So it's difficult, but it's a sort of a fun activity. So Tuesday dinners are a sort of a fun social activity that I'm doing at the moment.
Nice. Get your sushi mat out.
That's it.
Bardi, how about you? What are you having for dinner?
I'm going to go into the kitchen after this and have a fiddle around and try and make a deep pan pizza. I've been on the quest to try and find some flour to make my own sourdough, but I can't find flour anywhere, so I've managed to get hold of some self-raising flour. So I'm going to go in the kitchen and bash around some dough and see what comes out. If that's rubbish, I've been relying heavily on Gusto, so I'm going to open up my fresh delivery from Gusto and see what's inside.
Nice.
Everyone's making bread, that's where the flour's gone.
It's insane. I want to make my little own live yeast and then feed it olives and then split it, make another one and feed it bits and bobs just to see what flavours it takes hold of. But I can't find flour anywhere.
Yeah, definitely a shortage on bread flour. I managed to get some because my girlfriend had some in her cupboard. So I'm going to be making some bread this week. I've got some steak in the fridge at the moment. And it looks really good. So I'm going to do sirloin steak with béarnaise butter, and I'm going to make some cubed roast potatoes, I think, to go with that, and some tender stem broccoli.
Oh, I've been really enjoying tender stem broccoli recently. I'm on a big tender stem sort of vibe at the moment.
Al dente, I assume?
Yeah, yeah. No. Sorry. I have a lot of things al dente, but my broccoli I cook beyond recognition, much to the...
Right, okay. Yeah, okay.
Much to the ire of others, but that's how I like my broccoli.
I like broccoli with a bit of crunch to it. Good. Size other question is, what's more important, finishing this season or starting the next one in time to finish for the rescheduled Euros? That's a really difficult question to answer. Bardi, have you got a solution?
I don't have an answer for that. I think probably... Part of me wants to see the Premier League burn from last season. So let's just, I really want to just see what happens. I think the fallout, if we just null and void last season, would be great. So I'm going to say we should just kill it off and start again.
And Nathan, how about you?
Okay, to not be a Spurs fan about it, the most sensible thing would be to end the season as it is now, as everyone is stood, and therefore we don't qualify for even Europa League football, I don't think. Liverpool were awarded the win. Certain teams are relegated, and they may feel very hard done by that. I'm very sympathetic, but I think that we can't. Again, this is going to go on a lot longer than people are discussing, than health officials or government ministers are comfortable discussing, because people will not accept it and then not abide by it. But we're not going to see football for months and months and months and months. Are we really going to carry on this season from that standpoint? I think that we end this season as it is placed. And then only when it is safe to do so do we look at worrying about when the Euros have been rescheduled for. Maybe they have to be rescheduled for another year after that or whatever. I don't think we're going to... like, there's no point in waiting around for a September or an August to get a normal Premier League season started in. We just wait until it's ready. And I don't think there's much point in trying to plan it out now, because you'll only have to scrap them again.
So the Euros is interesting, because I can't even begin to imagine the amount of planning that must go into an event like that. Moving that would just be a complete nightmare debacle. I mean, I think personally that we're kind of too tied to the Football League calendar in our thinking about this. And Actually, you're right that this is going to go on for a long, long time. So why don't we just plan 3 years ahead and knock three seasons back a bit to squeeze in the end of this one? I think it's more important to finish the season personally. Okay. If that meant that the next two seasons or three seasons are then adjusted to compensate for that, then I'm all for it. You know, why not? I think, and then maybe in 3 years' time you get back to a point where we're starting at roughly the right time. But the only impact, of course, with that is the transfer windows. But why can't we move the transfer window? You know, there's no obvious, to me, it doesn't seem like an obvious reason why.
Are we currently still meant to be going ahead with the windows as they are, even though the seasons are paused or scrapped or unknown?
As far as I'm aware, there's been no announcement on the transfer windows yet. Nice. So I presume they're kind of thinking about these things. But yeah, I'm all for just shifting everything back.
And of course, the Qatar World Cup is going to come around in a winter in the near future anyway. So everything's already about to be thrown all over the place.
Yeah, exactly.
Hopefully that gets scrapped now.
Yeah, it would be nice, wouldn't it? Okay, so many more questions. We'll plough through. Anthony Kennedy says, if we buy a goalkeeper, who should it be? Bardi, you love talking about goalkeepers, and I know you like Onana.
Yeah.
Oh.
Is he your first choice?
I think so. It's goalkeepers at the moment are the very strange beast. Like, if you look at Kepa, for example, who was good, young, promising goalkeeper, he looks terrible. Napoli signed Alex Meret, who was meant to be a good, young goalkeeper. Both of them just remind me of cats. They're just flapping a paw at everything. And I think Onana looks, for me at the moment, I'm sure there are others out there, but I just like his style of goalkeeping. I mean, I was shocked that he's 6'3". He looks absolutely tiny, but he's a big chap. He just seems to be all round a bit more stable, and I think he's probably ready to come in now as a starter. But whether we would do that with Hugo Lloris still at the club is, I don't think so. I don't think Hugo's going anywhere anytime soon. So I don't see a signing Onana unless we sell Hugo. We'll never have both of them at the club at the same time. It just doesn't make any sense to do that.
I really like Onana. Do you have any thoughts on Lille's keeper?
No, I don't. I've been enjoying when Fiorentina went out there and signed Lafont. I was just like, that's a really brave move, and it's interesting to see what happened, but it hasn't quite worked out for him in Italy. But I think that's a goalkeeper as well to look at. But everybody seems to be moving big and early with goalkeepers, and they're very, very expensive just because, like Donnarumma, for example, I'm still not fully sold on him as being Buffon's future, but you can't buy him now. There's not enough money in the world to buy him. And if you look at the price goalkeepers move for, Pickford, Kepa, I'm sure there's someone else that slipped my mind. They're just so expensive that, they're not very good. It's not great value there at the moment.
Yeah, no, you're right. Alisson and Ederson are the two obvious other examples of high value, but they both add so much to the team.
Yeah, Nathan has just slid into my DMs to say Milan have put Donnarumma up for sale. He's for sale. Every player's for sale, but I don't see... It's going to take up over £100 million bid to get him, and I don't know if anybody has that money now in this climate. Milan would sell anybody for money, but I just don't see it happening.
Nathan, you do some scouting. You communicate with other scouts.
Yeah.
Are there any kind of under-the-radar goalkeepers that you like?
No, because goalkeepers is very much a blank spot for me. I like Onana. I really like Onana, but outside of that, I don't have strong goalkeeper thoughts. I'm not really keeping my eyes open on them.
The other goalkeeper I really like, and I'm intrigued to see how this pans out over the next couple of years, because it has to come to a head at some point, is Dean Henderson.
Yeah.
The Man U goalkeeper who's currently on loan at Sheffield United. I think he's had a really, really impressive season for Sheffield. I mean, he was good last year as well. He's been England's under 21 goalkeeper for a while. He's excellent, really excellent. But De Gea's, the rumours linking De Gea with moves away seem to have died down. Whether United will try and manufacture a move for De Gea so that they can then use Henderson as their first choice, I don't know. But that situation will definitely have to come to a head over the next year, 18 months. And if there's a possibility of us getting in there while there's uncertainty and getting Henderson, I'd be all for that. He's 23, so he's a good age to be signing from a goalkeeper, and I really like him. Right, Daniel Sermon says, I've got a question regarding something Nathan touched on in the last pod. I'd love to hear an in-depth discussion about Spurs' scouting. In particular, I'd love to hear about the top three players in each crucial positions we need to sign. Defensive midfield, right back, left back, striker. Maybe even a future replacement for Hugo. Well, we just kind of covered that. He says, also, any centre-backs you guys like, you'd like to see a sign. And he'd like to hear a bit about their attributes and shortcomings. Now, I don't think we've got time to go through and do top three in each of those positions. But actually, frankly, I'm not great these days at identifying possible new players because I'm so out of touch with other leagues. But Bardi, I know you certainly watch a lot of Italian football and you've got your finger on the pulse with Champions League as well. Is there anyone that you've got your eye on?
I've spoken many times about him. Tonali is the player I'd like us to sign.
All right, I'm not big on Tonali for us. I think he's a very good player, obviously, but I think that he is a misfit for our needs. I think he profiles sort of somewhat like Harry Winks in that his passing is very strong, but I don't think he's got the sort of defensive side to his game that is what we need.
And Nathan, do you have any players in mind for any of our problem positions?
I certainly agree with the sort of chosen positions that are left blank there. I mean, yeah, you've left me sort of weeks of content there. It's a single question. Chris Summersell wrote a really good three-part article on defensive midfielders, who we should be looking at, and I am in pretty much complete agreement. Those are the same names that I had good reviews on all of them. I will have to link to his article, but he finds Sangare, Grealish, Frontino Luiz, Dennis Zakaria, the whole gang.
All good players. Chris is great, by the way. Yeah, definitely look up his stuff and follow him on Twitter. He's always got something interesting to say. Right back, I would be very disappointed if we didn't sign the young right back from the Championship, because there's so much potential there. Left back, I think, is slightly more problematic. I wish we'd signed Chilwell four years ago. I don't know what we do with left back. I'd like to think that Sessegnon will be our left back and we don't need to worry about it, but I do think we'd probably need some competition for him, because I don't think Ben Davies is quite up to it. And then I do think we need a striker.
So
it depends on how we use Parrott, though.
I get asked about strikers a lot, and I always say, well, compared to searching for defensive midfielders or left backs, strikers are so much easier to scout, because you can just search by expected goals and they just sort of they fall right out like that. And I do stand by that as the process, but I thought, well, go on then, Nathan, why don't you actually fulfill on that and have a look? And I did have a look, and there's not a lot of good strikers at the moment out there. Certainly not in the leagues where I've got statistics available for. There's a bit of a gap. I've mentioned before I'd like Odson Edouard in Scotland.
I really like it.
But there's not a huge... Oh, okay. If bear with me here. If we go down the route of saying Parrott is really good, Parrott's going to break through, but we just need to give him some time. There was some news circulating yesterday that West Ham are putting up all of their players for sale, basically. So I would buy Haller or Haller, whatever.
Haller.
And just let him fill in as a sort of a target man for a season and a half while we bring Parrott through around the edges.
That news about West Ham intrigued me. And I had to think about which West Ham players I would take. There are so few of them. Honestly, their squad's in a mess.
There's talent in that squad. It's just that... I mean, it's kind of like ours, right? In that, like, there is some talented, like, attacking players, but it doesn't function as a squad because there's gaping holes.
There's lots of untapped potential, but they're risky moves and often at the wrong age profile as well. So
that's true.
Felipe Anderson is a really, really good player. 30. Mikel Antonio is a good player. He's 30. Lanzini, who I've loved for years, is a very good player, but he's injury-prone. He's now getting old. Yeah, so you don't want to sign him. The only player that I would take as a short-term option from West Ham, and I think Allaire is a good shout, by the way. I think, yeah, why not as a striker? The only other one is Fabianski, who I think is a fantastic underrated goalkeeper.
Boom.
And if we needed a goalkeeper for a year or two as a backup, then yeah, all for Fabianski coming in. I mean, frankly, he's been better than Lloris for the last two seasons.
Pablo Fornals.
Is he good?
He's really good, dude. He's special. I hope that they sell him. Basically.
Okay, I've not seen much of him at all.
I think Fabianski is one of those goalkeepers that looks good because he's always busy and he does have a lot of saves to make. I think I'd take Issa Diop. I still think he's young enough. I still think he has moments where he looks pretty good. Haller's a good shout. So I think there are a couple of players in there. And Antonio is, I don't know, he's I can't even believe I'm saying this, but he's an insane footballer who I think would be an excellent impact sub that we could chuck on.
He is dynamite. It's hard to, I mean, he's a real impact player. He always plays well against us as well.
Yeah, I think that might just be where your basis of being excited for him might be.
But again, he's so injury prone. Again, another very, very injury prone player. The player we haven't mentioned, of course, is Declan Rice, who most of their fans will say is their biggest prospect. I don't rate Rice. What do you think of him, Nathan?
He's good off the ball defensively. That is where it comes to an end. Okay, he's really poor in his passing.
I fully agree.
He's like a parody of 15-16 Eric Dier.
Yeah.
That's true, but he's still better. But he's better than Eric
Dier. He completely ignores any pass if it's forward. He has no awareness of his surroundings when he's on the ball.
I still would trust him to make an interception or get in the way, at least kind of be like a sleeping policeman on a counter-attack. Eric Dier is a traffic cone that people just wander around. At least Rice might slow them down. I would rather have Rice playing as our holding midfielder than Eric Dier at the moment.
Yeah, I think I probably would too, actually. But I wouldn't want us to sign Declan Rice. I would much rather us persist with Oliver Skipp than sign Declan Rice, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is an interesting one. This is from Mick, who is Mickey Bobbin or Bobin. Thoughts on how reffing could be more consistent? Bardi, any ideas about how to improve the standard of refereeing?
I don't think this is a problem that's going to get fixed quickly. I think referees, it's ridiculous to say this, but referees just need to be better. They need to be trained better. There has to be a way that they move along up to the Premier League, because VAR is, I'm not against VAR, but I just think there's a problem fundamentally with British referees. I mean, obviously I watch more English football than anything else, but I think their base decisions are incorrect a lot of the times. And yeah, I don't know how we fix this. Maybe VAR becomes quicker. Maybe we have pitch side monitors to help them. But I do think a lot of the time referees are just relying on VAR to get them out of a hole sometimes. And VAR doesn't always do that.
How about you, Nathan?
I think much like when Ben Davies was injured, he got better in the perception of fans because he was missing. I think that this is a really good time for VAR, that everyone's getting a break for it. But also, as my friend Thiago pointed out the other day, people are going back and watching old games. And if you watch old games without VAR, my goodness, the calls that are missed, the blatant penalties that aren't even a discussion point, the horrific fouls that are just disregarded. I don't know, like, obviously VAR has a lot of issues with it still, but I think that it is superior than just one bloke has to be aware of everything that's going on around him, the other side of the pitch, in finite detail, seeing it once. I just give VAR more time to iron itself out, I think. And also, we need to do a better job of prioritising the sort of in-stadium fan experience with it.
Yeah, totally.
Nathan's right about when you go back and watch old matches, you're like, how is that even not... Why is it not even a foul? Why is that not a penalty? How is he given that? It's incredible how much VAR has stopped the problems, but it also right that there needs to be more done for the in-house support, in-house celebrations. What annoys me the most about people complaining about VAR is that you're taking away my celebration. No, because if it's the right decision, you get two celebrations. Yeah. If it's the wrong decision, you shouldn't have been celebrating in the first place. So shut up.
Oh, Bardi, never change.
Beautiful.
I've got two fairly practical things that don't relate necessarily to stuff on the pitch that I think would help drive up refereeing standards. The first is a respect campaign, and I think I can't believe this hasn't happened, frankly, over the last few years. But I think anyone who is caught abusing a referee, and be like muttering under their breath, walking away, calling them a C-word, that should be an automatic yellow card. And if that means that lots of players get sent off for two yellows, then so be it.
Yep.
It's a short-term hit to fix that problem, and referees are suddenly then treated with some respect. That has a knock-on effect of making life easier at grassroots level as well, because you know referees have to start somewhere, and we want to encourage better refereeing, but we also want to encourage more referees to get into the game, because you've then got a bigger pool to pick from. And the other thing is miking them up so we can understand the decision-making process. I think people are very critical of referees because it's difficult sometimes to tell what's going through their heads. You don't really know, like, the detail that... As fans, sometimes we have a sort of passing knowledge of football's rules and regulation, but we won't necessarily have the kind of the flow chart that a referee has in their head, the detailed flow chart that says, is this a decision at this level? Then yes, you proceed to this decision. And it's happened so quickly, but them being mic'd up so you can understand as a fan what they're thinking, I think would really help with their perception and the complexity of the roles they're doing. I also, frankly, quite like the idea of having a referee in each half of the pitch. I think I'm surprised that the fourth official isn't given more license to help as it is, but having a referee in each half, which I think was trialled at a tournament at some point a few years ago, I'm surprised we haven't seen that introduced, but I guess VAR has done away with that need. But I think those two practical things would be very simple to implement and would have a big wide-reaching effect on refereeing at grassroots level as well.
I think those are two fantastic ideas, Chris.
I really hate the fact that players get away with swearing at the referee and being abusive.
I don't mind swearing, but it's the squaring up surrounding the referee stuff really bothers me.
It's bullying, basically. It's horrible. It's just not a nice thing to see someone having to go through, frankly. Yeah. Final question. This is an interesting one. This is from Russ Green, who is Green Giant. And Russ has been a listener from the very start of the Extra Inch. So thank you, Russ, for all your questions and feedback. He says, thoughts on Amazon potentially being the stadium sponsor? Nike also being considered, but if you could pick a stadium sponsor, who would it be and why? Bardi, what do you think about Amazon and who would your ideal stadium sponsor be?
I'm not too sure about Amazon. I'd like someone who doesn't have issues with how they treat their staff and forcing staff to work. And so I'm not too keen on Amazon. It's difficult to pick. It's difficult to pick a company that you'd want to fully support or that has the kind of money that we need. Obviously, I've been really impressed with how BrewDog, what they've been doing with the way they've been creating hand sanitizer, yeah, stuff like that. But they're not big enough. And unfortunately, these kind of medium sized companies aren't what we're looking for. We're looking for a conglomerate. So if we're looking at conglomerate level, top level of sponsors, then that's Starbucks, no. KFC, no, it's ridiculous. McDonald's, I'd go for McDonald's over Pizza Hut or Domino's or anything like that. So if we've got to go for one of these big conglomerates, which is essentially what we're doing, then McDonald's or Nike over Facebook or anything else like that.
Nathan, how about you? Any thoughts?
I prefer not to speak.
I feel so detached from this, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think it's a really interesting point, and I think the reaction of fans to inverted commas bad companies becoming sponsors or stadium sponsors or whatever, I think is fascinating, because actually no one's going to stop going to see Spurs because their stadium is sponsored by a company whose values they don't agree with, or a handful of people might, but not enough to have an impact. So ultimately it's a discussion that means very little. But I mean, this is just, it's the side of football that I've never liked or been particularly interested in, so I just sort of turn a blind eye to it and do my best to ignore it, which is a really bad way of dealing with it, frankly. But it just makes my life easier.
But these are, if you look across America, these are the Home Depot Stadium. It's a common thing that's happened in America, and that's what Spurs are holding out for. Unfortunately, there's not going to be the company that we want that has its values and has its ethics in line with what we want to see from a sponsor. The only thing we can ask for is it's not named something ridiculously stupid.
Or no red logos.
Or no red logos, or we don't end up being called the Sports Direct Lane or something ridiculous. Like
Dunkin'
that.
Donuts.
Just something that doesn't make us look like an idiot, and then I'm fully on board with that. I'm talking about Football Manager. I'm playing FM 2012 just because I just wanted to go back in time and play something. And Spurs have just built their stadium. They called it the Perryman Stadium, which is lovely, but that's not going to happen these days.
Now that is the dream. Yes. Name it after a legendary
player. We'll just call it White Hart Lane, regardless.
Obviously. I mean, we should of course do that. Yeah, boys, it's been a pleasure. It's been a long old podcast, but it's been a pleasure. You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindner for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud D Lindner. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.